From Pomonic starting, I fly like a bird, around and around, to soar, to sing the idea of all. To the north, betaking myself to sing their Arctic songs. To Canada, till I absorb Canada in myself. To Michigan, then. To Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, to sing their songs. They are inimitable. Then to Ohio and Indiana to sing theirs. To Missouri and Kansas and Arkansas to sing theirs. To Tennessee and Kentucky, to the Carolinas and Georgia to sing theirs. To Texas, and so along up toward California. To Rome, accepted everywhere. To sing first, to the tap of the war drum of need be. The idea of all, of the Western world one and inseparable. And then the song of each member of these states.
News of the attack on Fort Sumter and the flag at Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, was received in New York City late at night, 13th April, 1861, and was immediately sent out in extras of the newspapers. I had been to the opera in 14th Street that night, and after the performance was walking down Broadway toward 12 o'clock, on my way to Brooklyn, when I heard in the distance the loud cries of the newsboys, who came presently tearing and yelling up the street, rushing from side to side even more furiously than usual. I bought an extra and crossed to the Metropolitan Hotel, where the great lamps were still brightly blazing, and, with a crowd of others, who gathered impromptu, read the news, which was evidently authentic. For the benefit of some who had no papers, one of us read the telegram aloud, while all listened silently and attentively. No remark was made by any of the crowd, which had increased to 30 or 40, but all stood a minute or two, I remember, before they dispersed. I can almost see them there now, under the lamps at midnight again.
"1861. Armed year, year of the struggle. No dainty rhymes or sentimental love verses for you, terrible year. Not you as some pale poetling seated at a desk lisping cadenzas piano, but as a strong man erect, clothed in blue clothes, advancing, carrying a rifle on your shoulder, with well-gristled body and sunburnt face and hands, with a knife in the belt at your side, as I heard you shouting loud, your sonorous voice ringing across the continent, your masculine voice, O year, as rising amid the great cities. Amid the men of Manhattan I saw you as one of the workmen, the dwellers in Manhattan, or with large steps crossing the prairies out of Illinois and Indiana, rapidly crossing the west, with springy gait and descending the Alleghenies, or down from the Great Lakes or in Pennsylvania, or on deck along the Ohio River, or southward along the Tennessee or Cumberland Rivers, or at Chattanooga on the mountaintop, saw I your gait, and saw I your sinewy limbs clothed in blue, bearing weapons, robust year. Heard your determined voice launched forth again and again, year that suddenly sang by the mouths of the round-lipped cannon, I repeat you, hurrying, crashing, sad, distracted year. Year that trembled and reeled beneath me, year that trembled and reeled beneath me, your summer wind was warm enough, yet the air I breathed froze me. A thick gloom fell through the sunshine and darkened me. Must I change my triumphant songs? Said I to myself. Must I indeed learn to chant the cold dirges of the baffled and sullen hymns of defeat?
Even after the bombardment of Sumter, however, the gravity of the revolt and the power and will of the slave states for a strong and continued military resistance to national authority were not at all realized at the North, except by a few. 9/10 of the people of the free states looked upon the rebellion, as started in South Carolina, from a feeling one half of contempt and the other half composed of anger and incredulity. It was not thought it would be joined in by Virginia, North Carolina, or Georgia. A great and cautious national official predicted that it would blow over in 60 days, and folks generally believed the prediction. I remember talking about it on a Fulton ferry boat with the Brooklyn mayor, who said he only hoped the Southern fire eaters would commit some overt act of resistance, as they would then be at once so effectually squelched we would never hear of secession again. But he was afraid they never would have the pluck to really do anything. I remember, too, that a couple of companies of the 13th Brooklyn, who rendezvoused at the city armory and started thence as 30 days men, were all provided with pieces of rope, conspicuously tied to their musket barrels, with which to bring back, each man, a prisoner from the audacious South, to be led in a noose on our men's early and triumphant return. Beat, beat, drums. Beat, beat, drums. Blow, bugles, blow. Through the windows, through doors, burst like a ruthless force into the solemn church and scatter the congregation into the school where the scholar is studying. Leave not the bridegroom quiet. No happiness must he have now with his bride, nor the peaceful farmer any peace, plowing his field or gathering his grain. So fierce you whir and pound, you drums, so shrill you bugles blow. Beat, beat, drums, blow, bugles blow. Over the traffic of cities, over the rumble of wheels in the streets, our beds prepared for sleepers at night in the houses. No sleepers must sleep in those beds. No bargainers bargains by day. No brokers or speculators would they continue. Would the talkers be talking? Would the singer attempt to sing? Would the lawyer rise in the court to state his case before the judge? Then rattle quicker, heavier drums. You bugles wilder blow. Beat, beat drums. Blow, bugles, blow. Make no parley. Stop for no expostulation. Mind not the timid. Mind not the weeper or prayer. Mind not the old man beseeching the young man. Let not the child's voice be heard, nor the mother's entreaties. Make even the trestles to shake the dead where they lie, awaiting the hearses. So strong you thump, O terrible drums. So loud you bugles blow.
All this sort of feeling was destined to be arrested and reversed by a terrible shock, the Battle of First Bull Run. Certainly, as we now know it, one of the most singular fights on record. All battles and their results are far more matters of accident than is generally thought. But this was throughout a casualty, a chance. Each side supposed it had won till the last moment. One had, in point of fact, just the same right to be routed as the other. By a fiction, or a series of fictions, the national forces at the last moment exploded in a panic and fled from the field. The defeated troops commenced pouring into Washington over the Long Bridge at daylight on Monday 22nd. Day drizzling all through with rain. The Saturday and Sunday of the battle, 20th, 21st, had been parched and hot to an extreme. The dust, the grime, and smoke, in layers sweated in, followed by other layers again sweated in, absorbed by those excited souls, their clothes all saturated with the clay powder filling the air, stirred up everywhere on the dry roads and trodden fields by the regiments, swarming wagons, artillery, and so forth, all the men with this coating of murk and sweat and rain, now recoiling back, pouring over the Long Bridge. A horrible march of 20 miles,
returning to Washington baffled, humiliated, panic-struck. Where are the vaunts and the proud boasts with which you went forth? Where are your banners and your bands of music and your ropes to bring back your prisoners? Well, there isn't a band playing, and there isn't a flag but clings ashamed and lank to its staff. The sun rises but shines not. The men appear at first sparsely and shamefaced enough, then thicker in the streets of Washington, appear in Pennsylvania Avenue and on the steps and basement entrances. They come along in disorderly mobs, some in squads, stragglers, companies. Occasionally a rare regiment in perfect order with its officers, some gaps, dead, the true braves, marching in silence with lowering faces, stern, weary to sinking, all black and dirty, but every man with his musket and stepping alive. But these are the exceptions. Sidewalks of Pennsylvania Avenue, 14th Street, and so forth, crowded, jammed with citizens. Good people, but not over many of them either, hurry up something for their grub. They put wash kettles on the fire for soup, for coffee. They set tables on the sidewalks. Wagon loads of bread are purchased, swiftly cut in stout chunks. Here are two aged ladies, beautiful, the first in the city for culture and charm. They stand with store of eating and drink at an improvised table of rough plank and give food and have the store replenished from their house every half hour all that day. And there in the rain they stand, active, silent, white-haired, and give food, though the tears stream down their cheeks, almost without intermission, the whole time. Amid the deep excitement, crowds and motion, and desperate eagerness, it seems strange to see many, very many, of the soldiers sleeping. In the midst of all, sleeping sound. They drop down anywhere, on the steps of houses, up close by the basements or fences, on the sidewalk, aside on some vacant lot, and deeply sleep. A poor 17 or 18-year-old boy lies there on the stoop of a grand house. He sleeps so calmly, so profoundly. Some clutch their muskets firmly, even in sleep, some in squads, comrades, brothers, close together, and on them, as they lay, sulkily drips the rain. Meantime in Washington, among the great persons and their entourage, a mixture of awful consternation, uncertainty, rage, shame, helplessness, and stupefying disappointment. The worst is not only imminent, but already here. In a few hours, perhaps before the next meal, the Secesh generals with their victorious hordes will be upon us. The dream of humanity, the vaunted Union we thought so strong, so impregnable. Lo, it seems already smashed like a china plate. One bitter, bitter hour. Perhaps proud America will never again know such an hour. She must pack and fly. No time to spare. Those white palaces, the dome-crowned capitol there on the hill, so stately over the trees, shall they be left or destroyed first? For it is certain that the talk among certain of the magnates and officers and clerks and officials everywhere for 24 hours in and around Washington after Bull Run was loud and undisguised for yielding out and out and substituting the Southern rule and Lincoln promptly abdicating and departing. If the Secesh officers and forces had immediately followed and by a bold Napoleonic movement had entered Washington the first day, or even the second, they could have had things their own way and a powerful faction north to back them. One of our returning colonels expressed in public that night, amid a swarm of officers and gentlemen in a crowded room, the opinion that it was useless to fight, that the Southerners had made their title clear, and that the best course for the national government to pursue was to desist from any further attempt at stopping them and admit them again to the lead on the best terms they were willing to grant. Not a voice was raised against this judgment amid that large crowd of officers and gentlemen.
L-
Long, too long, America. Long, too long, America. Traveling roads all even and peaceful, you learned from joys and prosperity only. But now, now, to learn from crises of anguish, advancing, grappling with direst fate and recoiling not. And now to conceive and show to the world what your children en masse really are. For who, except myself, has yet conceived what your children en masse really are? An Army Corps on the march. With its cloud of skirmishers in advance, with now the sound of a single shot snapping like a whip, and now an irregular volley, the swarming ranks press on and on. The dense brigades press on, glittering dimly, toiling under the sun. The dust-covered men in columns rise and fall to the undulations of the ground, with artillery interspersed. The wheels rumble, the horses sweat, as the Army Corps advances. But the hour, the day, the night passed, and whatever returns, an hour, a day, a night like that can never again return. The president, recovering himself, begins that very night, sternly, rapidly sets about the task of reorganizing his forces and placing himself in positions for future and surer work. If there were nothing else of Abraham Lincoln for history to stamp him with, it is enough to send him with his wreath to the memory of all future time that he endured that hour, that day, bitterer than gall, indeed a crucifixion day, that it did not conquer him, that he unflinchingly stemmed it and resolved to lift himself and the Union out of it. To sum up the foregoing from the outset, and of course far, far more unrecorded, I estimate three leading sources and formative stamps to my own character, now solidified for good or bad, and its subsequent literary and other outgrowth. The maternal nativity stock brought hither from faraway Netherlands, for one, doubtless the best. The subterranean tenacity and central bony structure, obstinacy, willfulness, which I get from my paternal English elements, for another, and the combination of my Long Island birth spot, seashores, childhood scenes, absorptions with teeming Brooklyn and New York, with, I suppose, my experiences afterward in the secession outbreak, for the third. In 1862, startled by news that my brother George, an officer in the 51st New York Volunteers, had been seriously wounded, first Fredericksburg Battle, December 13th, I hurriedly went down to the field of war in Virginia. But I must go back a little. Bivouac on a mountainside. I see before me now a traveling army halting. Below, a fertile valley spread with barns and the orchards of summer. Behind, the terraced sides of a mountain, abrupt, in places rising high, broken with rocks, with clinging cedars, with tall shapes dingily seen, the numerous campfires scattered near and far, some away up on the mountain, the shadowing forms of men and horses looming large-sized, flickering, and over all the sky, far, far out of reach, studded, breaking out the eternal stars. December 23rd to 31st. The results of the late battle are exhibited everywhere about here in thousands of cases. Hundreds die every day in the camp, brigade, and division hospitals. These are merely tents, and sometimes very poor ones. the wounded lying on the ground, lucky if their blankets are spread on layers of pine or hemlock twigs or small leaves. No cots, seldom even a mattress. It is pretty cold. The ground is frozen hard, and there is occasional snow. I go around from one case to another. I do not see that I do much good to these wounded and dying, but I cannot leave them. Once in a while, some youngster holds on to me convulsively, and I do what I can for him. At any rate, stop with him and sit near him for hours if he wishes it. Vigil strange I kept on the field one night. Vigil strange I kept on the field one night, when you, my son, and my comrade dropped at my side that day. One look I but gave, which your dear eyes returned, with a look I shall never forget. One touch of your hand to mine, O boy, reached up as you lay on the ground. Then onward I sped in the battle, the even contested battle, till late in the night, relieved to the place, at last again I made my way. Found you in death so cold, dear comrade, found your body, son, of responding kisses, never again on earth responding. Bared your face in the starlight, curious the scene. Cool blew the moderate night wind. Long there and then in vigil I stood, dimly around me the battlefield spreading. Vigil wondrous and vigil sweet, there in the fragrant silent night. But not a tear fell, not even a long-drawn sigh. Long, long I gazed. Then on the earth partially reclining, sat by your side, leaning my chin in my hands, passing sweet hours, immortal and mystic hours with you, dearest comrade. Not a tear, not a word. Vigil of silence, love, and death. Vigil for you, my son and my soldier. As onward silently stars aloft, eastward new ones upward stole, vigil final for you, brave boy. I could not save you, swift was your death. I faithfully loved you and cared for you living. I think we shall surely meet again. Till at latest lingering of the night, indeed just as the dawn appeared, my comrade I wrapped in his blanket, enveloped well his form,